Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight we will go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score that would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and its Memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network. In conjunction with Swish Enterprises, we're live from the Wallingford, Connecticut home of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 140-plus years of football history and memorabilia. You can find us on the web at GridironGreatsMagazine.com. We're sponsored in part by MSB Sports Cards. Check out their website for one of the largest selections of football cards and football memorabilia at MSBSportsCards.com. And we're also sponsored in part by BST Auctions. Check out their upcoming fall auction with some incredible, one-of-a-kind football memorabilia and card pieces. Check out their website and register today for their new auction, BSTAuctions.com. It is at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host, who is a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Larger. He hails from Portland, Oregon. Mr. Joe Squires, Joe! Welcome to the show this evening.
The dramatic pauses are getting better and better each week, Captain. I love it.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. We are in fall. We are in the time frame where each weekend, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday night, we're seeing football literally 24/7. I'm starting off this season enjoying some local high school games and some good college games. Not overly thrilled with the NFL game. However, that's a topic for another evening. However, there's something that has kind of been on my mind for quite a while, and you and I have talked about this, not in public, but privately. And we're going to talk about it tonight, and it's going to be our opening dialogue. And for those regular listeners, you know, Joe and I banter about a current topic of a card set or whatever. But tonight we're going to do something a little differently. We're going to talk about and we're going to give our opinions on how we feel the football memorabilia and the football card markets get impacted by literally the hundreds of auctions that are taking place during the year from many, many different avenues, many, many different sources, many different auction houses, eBays, Amazon, you name it, it is there. And I'm going to start off by just giving a few of my feelings, and I'm going to hand off to you, Joe. But I think in my mind and in my opinion and talking to some of the old-timers in the hobby, I think there's an auction overload going on currently. And I think the auction overload is a combination of a couple of factors, that some individuals may be buying pieces and then trying to re-auction them very, very quickly for whatever reason. A, some cases they need to cash that purchase.
Good point.
Other cases,
good point,
they're trying to turn in a profit. Other cases, the item that they really wanted, they were probably sleep deprived and they stayed up 14 hours straight to win the auction and then realized, regrettably, they made a mistake. They may have bought a second item they thought they didn't have, but they found it, so on and so forth. And I was talking recently to a longtime collector, a reader of GG, and he basically said to me, you know, Bob, I'm old school. I'm from the Avenue. I go to shows. I like buying things at shows. I like going to the National. I like buying things at the National. But I am just inundated with auction after auction after auction. And I don't even, really don't even know where to look or where to turn to. And, you know, he likes the concepts of like a BST auction that does a, you know, a football-only type of auction. And I like
focus,
that too.
Yeah.
And we know several other, you know, we know Heritage does some football only, and several other larger auction houses do football only, some football only auctions, so on and so forth. So handing it off to you and throwing it out to you, do you have any thoughts, any ideas of what we're looking at tonight as far as an overload is concerned?
Yeah, you missed one there. Love of the Games. Al Crisafulli did a football-only auction, like 4 years ago, and I think the auction ended or started around the Super Bowl. I can't remember when, but you know that was a very good offering as well. Had a Nagurski in there.
My apologies to Al and Love of the Game auction. A gridiron great advertiser. I don't know. My mind went blank on that with my notes here. But yeah, Al has that football-only auction. Normally at the end of the season, there beginning of Super Bowl weeks. So go ahead,
okay, Bob. I'm I know my role here is first comedy first, and then you know picking up you know on the advertisers where you let go. So a couple things, you know, I notice it all. They, you know, they call it, you know, auction fatigue. You know, you know things start happening in the fall. You get more and more auctions. And there's some auction houses. You know, baseball is and always will be the undisputed heavyweight when it comes to auctions.
Correct.
Their items garner more money. And I think it was Al who told me years ago, he found, you know, not scientifically, but football collectors tend to buy stuff and then hang on to it. Baseball collectors tend to buy stuff, and when they want something else, they sell something to make room, you know, to make room for it. Me, if I want something, I get the money together. You know, I go sell blood or whatever. And that characterization kind of stunned me because he's spot on. I mean, I have stuff that's been in my collection for 10 years, and I don't plan on letting it go. So perhaps he's right. Football collectors hang on to more stuff. But, if you do a quick snapshot of the registry sets that are on PSA right now, you'll find, and I've looked at this before, let's say there's 100 baseball sets. There's probably, you know, just using ratios here. If there's 100 baseball sets, there's 20 football, there's 9 basketball, and there's 3 hockey. Baseball is over 4 times as many sets as the other 3 sports combined. So there, you know, if you're using that as a litmus to how much should be available from the other sports in relation to baseball in an auction, then that's your ratio right there. And then if you throw that in with football collectors tend to hoard their stuff more than they do rotate it through, then, you know, that makes sense.
Let's look at the scenario while you're on that with a 3-to-1 ratio. And I've been told by other dealers and the like, it was like 5-1, 6-1, 7-1. Pick a number. I mean, it's out of proportion. You know what I mean? So let's look at the scenario. Let's go back in time to the early days of eBay, when eBay was truly an auction type of website, where you saw a lot of stuff that realistically you haven't seen literally when I first started going on eBay, I felt like I was at a sports memorabilia show on a daily basis with stuff I had not seen at shows. And again, I go back, you know, I started going to shows late 70s, early 80s, when really it was nothing. You know, shows were really minimal. But, you know, totally. You did find certain things, so on and so forth. So if we evolved eBay from its beginning to where we are at today, where eBay is really not an auction type of website anymore, it's more of a store, fixed price type of buy it now type
Absolutely.
Of auction house. How has that impacted, has that allowed the situation to occur today where we got so many auction houses and so many different auctions going on to actually replace an eBay? Is that
a great
plausible
point.
Theory?
No, without a doubt, that's plausible. I mean, I've moved away from eBay selling stuff, and it just happens to coincide with, PayPal, and people can file a claim against you months after they've received the item. eBay is all about, the buyer protecting the buyer, not the seller. I mean, that's allowed the proliferation of new auction houses. You see, as eBay fees start to rise, as more and more nefarious people are perusing eBay, looking to buy stuff and then ship back. I mean, I heard a horror story from a seller, who somebody bought something from him, said it wasn't as described. They quote unquote sent it back, but they sent back something else. Like they bought a raw card that was in, mint shape, and they sent back something that was crappy. Now you have to videotape yourself opening up a box when somebody returns something just to prove. And then he went to eBay and he said, the guy didn't send me back my card. And they're like, well, they got a delivery confirmation. That's all we care about. And the guy was out.
Right.
He was out his money. So, as more and more, like I said, nefarious. Go ahead, Gavin.
It was interesting to me because I was very heavy on eBay roughly from 98 up to, I want to say, maybe 2003. And then I slowed right down. And now I took probably a three-year break from them, and now I'm back on in a very, very limited manner.
Yeah.
But again, I agree with you. Listening to those horror stories, I'm fearful of really selling anything on eBay.
Yeah.
And what I sell is so minimal, it's really not worth my time. But I'll just keep the stuff up there, and to me, it's more advertising than anything else. So,
I'm blocked from selling on eBay because I don't print shipping labels through PayPal. eBay owns PayPal, so they pushed everything to, mandatory, compelling people to use PayPal. So now, because I might have sold, 20 things a year, it wasn't much, and I'd go in batches where I'd sell 10 things and then sit quiet for another. I didn't sell much, so I wasn't set up. So when eBay started compelling you to enter in tracking numbers through PayPal or else they dinged you, I didn't do that because I'm the guy who sells something. And then I bring it into my office, and I ask my, my assistants to mail the stuff. I don't bother. So when they blocked me from selling on eBay once because they're like, no, you have to enter in your tracking information. I'm like, I'm too busy to enter in my tracking information. So I can no longer sell on eBay. So why do I use an auction house? It's because of rules and policies that eBay has enacted that block little time sellers from me. So now when I have stuff to sell, I turn to an auction house.
And we are confirming on a national podcast, senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats magazine, Joe Squires, off of eBay. Not allowed to sell because of the ridiculous nature of their shipping rules of a tracking number, which to me is useless because stuff still gets lost and stuff still gets misdelivered. And I've had over the past 30 years, numerous times, tracking numbers say items have been delivered to my P.O. box, and they put it in the wrong P.O. box in Wallingford. And I am just fortunate that, I know enough people in town. They say, I'm not Bob Swick, we have 133, P.O. box 133, and I end up getting the item. But, stuff like that's ridiculous.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
But, they fixed the problem that wasn't – almost 4,000 positive feedback on eBay spanning 12 years. I'd never had something not get delivered no, zero negatives, and they banned me from selling because I wasn't, it's like, all right, if I had some complaints for not, getting stuff to the, to the destination, I can see you fixing them. But back to the topic, I checked up on this prior to the show. Using those same ratios, you can see baseball is, 3-1 or 4-1, for any of the other, for any of the other sports combined. And it's about 5-1 for football. So naturally, you're going to see more baseball than football. And you get some auctions, you can sift by category. And you get some auctions where, I can't remember the auction, but about a year ago, football was lumped together with the other section. I mean, and other, other in an auction is, like the children's table at Thanksgiving. I mean, you're there, you're eating the meal. It's just, you're missing out on the conversation. When you don't have enough football inventory in your auction to sell, to even put it together with, I can see why, why people struggle to have auctions that revolve around only football. I think mm-hmm. us football collectors hold on to our stuff tighter. Everybody's always looking for a deal. There's less material. Maybe we're cheaper. I don't know. It's hard to put us all in one, lump them together.
Look at what's on most hardcore football collector, longtime football card collectors' wants. 35 Chicles without a doubt.
Yep.
Mayo Cup plugs without a doubt. Any type of pre-World War II oddball item, any Shotwell. You know what everybody's looking for. So you see one, let's say we see one high number 35 Chickle, a nice shaped coat go up to auction. Well, you got probably got 25 collectors trying to get it. Half of them are going to back out when they see the price starting to really escalate. And then you end up with a bidding war for three or four of the real, deep-pocketed collectors who need that for their collection. And then the other 20 collectors are saying to themselves, well, what's the good of trying to put this stuff together? I'm never going to put the high numbers together, blah, blah, blah. And then, then you have that cycle again. You see a whole bunch of low numbers come out, and you're still looking for those high numbers. So it's a very, very valid point you brought up, is that football collectors will hold on to their items forever. And I've seen it. I continue to hear about it, and it's so true. It amazes me in a way. It really does. So,
that being said, I've heard from dealers before that, the majority of sales that happen in auction houses are bought by other dealers. So, I mean, dealers, let's call it 50%, of sales are other dealers who are buying stuff, because they know someone who wants to buy it. They think the price was low enough they can. So, I mean, the crappy dealers out there, the card doctors who see a card in a PSA 5 slab, who think they can get into a 7. I mean, as sad as it is, those people exist. But I mean, so if there are dealers out there looking for deals, and then you've got the moderate collectors and then the serious collectors, and you're probably right. I would say that's probably the case with baseball, where most auctions end up with 2 to 5 people who are serious about bidding. I mean, our football hobby is small enough that when a very esoteric thing comes up, I probably know who the other couple bidders are who I'm bidding
exactly.
against, because it's such a small communicated field.
I was just going to say that you know who you're going to bid. You're bidding up against on an item. You know who you're going to run up against, and you have a pretty good handle on who's got more money than somebody else to win that item. It all fall back to how bad do you need it and how bad do you want it and what you're willing to pay for it, type of thing. Which again leads me to believe take the price book and throw it out the window, because it's not a good guide anymore. You can't judge it in that manner, in any way, shape, or form. So,
I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'll go back to your original question: is does the football memorabilia market get impacted by the auctions take place during the year? And my answer to that is no. I mean, bring it on, because football is, 20% or, one-fifth, one-sixth of generally an auction, I want to see more stuff. I want to see, 400 football items you know, in a single auction. I want to see every single auction have a representation of football, because the more the merrier. I mean, right. You know, if I take a typical auction, there's generally four or five things I'm interested in. If it's a football-only auction like a BST or, you know, Love of the Game, then there's going to be more things.
Right.
And, if that auction runs a month with the preview and then the auction, and I see there's four or five things I want, I'm going to raise the cash or I'm going to sell something offline to generate the revenue. I don't know. I love auction time. I mean, I did reach out to the BST boys and said, you know, hey, can a brother get a sneak peek? I don't know who replied. Yeah, exactly. It was their generic email. They said preview's coming on Saturday, so we got about 3 days till we get a peek behind the the curtain and witness the great and powerful Oz. So.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a phenomenal auction. Well, we're out of time with our little banter here, so we're going to move on to our guest because he's waiting. Our guest tonight is the head of the research library at NFL Films, and he's written several books, including Old Brother, An Old History of Early Pro Football in Ohio, 1920 to 1935, which was published in 2005. His second book, which was The Columbus Panhandles, A Complete History of Pro Football's Toughest Team, 1900 to 1922, was published in 2007. 2010, he wrote The Man Who Built the National Football League, Joe F. Carr, and he was on our show, believe it or not, in March of 2012, and we talked to him about Dutch Clark, The Life of an NFL Legend, and The Birth of the Detroit Lions. 2014, he wrote a nearly Perfect Season, The Inside Story of the Infamous 1984 San Francisco 49ers. He's a member of the Professional Football Researchers Association, and he's written many articles for them over the years. And Chris was a individual who wrote for my old Bob Swick's Football Time newsletter many, many years ago. I'd like to welcome to our show this evening noted author Chris Willis. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Bob and Joe. I do remember the Football Times. I still have them. You know, I think they're upstairs in my attic, and I might have to pull those out and take a look at those old articles.
Don't ever throw those out. They're very rare, and they command a very high price on the memorabilia market, from what I've been told.
There you go.
But not as high as Gridiron Great Issues number 1 and 2. So, but we're up there with our cult-like following that we had as Football Times was my response to being canned by Sports Collectors Digest in 1992 after writing for them for about 3 or 4 years when they underwent that big changeover there. And I said, you know, I like writing about this stuff. I'm just going to do it myself. And I did. And I've been doing it ever since for, I don't know, how many years now? Well, since 92. So it's over 25 years. So it's a long time. But in any event, Chris, let's start off. Tell us how you became a fan and a historian of early football history. And also give us some background on your position at NFL Films.
Sure, yeah. I mean, most of my sort of passion for pro football history, or especially football history, I mean, comes from my dad owned a used bookstore in Ohio. So if you know, Ohio is fertile ground for, the history of the game. So, you know, growing up in that environment, sort of trying to read everything I could, sort of in the sports section. So so that's how I sort of got into definitely reading about it and sort of learning about, the game and the history of football. And then you start watching Ohio State and the NFL. So, and that sort of led me to, I thought I wanted to maybe go into coaching, that sort of led me to Ohio State in grad school for sports history. And then while there, I sort of came to here in New Jersey to do an internship that evolved into a full-time role, running the research library here at NFL Films. So that's sort of the background of, how I got from Ohio and, to NFL Films.
Wow, that's incredible. And as I tell many people who I've told over the years about you,
they said you have a dream job, which is just incredible. just to be surrounded by that history, surrounded by that, the word and the film of the game is it's mind-boggling to me. I mean, if that was me, I think I would just gawk at everything after, and I wouldn't be able to get anything done because I would just be looking at everything, and it's truly amazing, to say the least.
Yeah,
but I do remember you contacting you and you wrote several articles for Football Times, and you were in grad school at the time. So I said to myself, this is good. I could get some interns in to help write. They could get some, course credit or whatever, get their byline out, so on and so forth. And look at where it got you, to NFL Films.
No, it definitely helped. I never thought writing would be, part of it. But, writing for Coffin Corner, for the PFRA, and then writing for the Football Time, sort of get that little bug. So it was definitely a good early experience.
Yeah, I mean, and Chris, that's why we still try to this day. We try to get a few interns with Gridiron Greats. We've had several over the years, mostly high school students, who've written several articles. If you remember in the Burt Jones edition, we had a gal who was a senior in high school, and she actually interviewed Burt Jones, and she said he was such a nice man, and Burt's a real class act. And he had no problem answering the questions and interviewing. It was amazing, truly amazing.
That was a really good article. Yeah, very well written.
We got a lot of compliments on it, and they really were impressed that a high school student wrote it. So it was good. Good situation.
Chris, your pedigree obviously, precedes you. That it's impressive what you've done, working for NFL Films and the books you've written. So with all those books being written, I'm curious, when can our readers expect a book focusing on Seattle Seahawk legend Steve Largent?
No, it's an interesting topic. I always encourage, I talked to a lot of potential writers or, people that would like to delve into a subject. And, I always encourage them to grab a stud, because there is a big bulk of football history that hasn't been written about, and it includes biographies, and things like players like Steve. I mean, these are great players. These are not just like the obscured, that guy. Yeah, that guy played in the 30s and nobody knows who he is. You're talking about, so somebody like Steve Largent, here's a Hall of Famer that nobody's written about. So, unlike baseball, and I know baseball, even golf and boxing, there's more books on the shelves. You go to Barnes & Noble, you go on Amazon, you're going to see a lot more, and I get that, but football still is untapped. There's some parts of some great players you're like, wow, nobody's written about. I mean, I always look at guys like
–
yeah, like Don Hutson. Nobody's written anything about Don Hutson. He's the greatest receiver until Jerry Rice, and there's not a solo biography on Don Hutson. So those are types of topics.
Greatest receiver until Steve Largent. Steve Largent broke Don Hudson's 100 touchdown record.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then probably 2 years later, Jerry Rice shattered all records. But anyways, I was kidding about Steve Largent. I would be remiss if I didn't get a Steve Largent joke in on every show.
Jerry, you better get moving on his autobiography. He's probably waiting for you to write it. And I could help you.
Well,
I could help you. And I can publish chapters in GG for you, too. So a lot of possibilities.
Due to a restraining order, I'm not allowed to have contact with Steve Largent. Chris, you're right. You're writing a book on Jim Thorpe and the Ouerang Indians, and between Jim Thorpe and Red Grange, probably two of the players that I focus most of my collection on. I have great admiration for these guys. Tell us about the book you have coming up on Thorpe.
Yeah, it just came out in May. If you're familiar with a little bit of the team, was it only played in 2 years, 1922, 1923.
Yep.
Jim Thorpe and the Ouerang Indians. And there's been a little bit of written about, not, I think, as in-depth as I liked with this book, but also there's a lot about water lingo. You know, I think most people are familiar, especially if you're a football fan and some football historians, you know Jim Thorpe's story, but water lingo, the owner who really developed a team to help sell, you know, Airedales, you know, because he owned a dog kennel in the small town in Ohio. So I focused on him a lot more. Obviously, I cover Thorpe, and you learn about him, and you know, but water lingo is also this other main character, you know, is sort of why. And I asked that question early in the book, is like, well, why did he do it? Because in 1922, his dog kennel was more popular than the NFL in professional football. You know, he was making more money. He was advertising a lot, you know. So why did he pick pro football in the NFL to sort of promote his business? And so so focusing on his story and his background and why he did it, and then obviously the 2 years that the team played, you know, it was a sort of fun little story that I always thought I would like to tackle, and I think it came out pretty good.
Nice.
That,
wow.
Chris,
when do you think that's going to come out?
When did that book actually come out? Is it out now?
It came out, it came out in May.
So
it's on Amazon. It's on Rowan Littlefield's my publisher, so it's on their website too. It's starting to make the rounds. I mean, it came out a little earlier than I would have liked, but as we got closer to the football season, I always wanted it. Most of my titles usually come out in the fall, so you definitely want it as the football season gets started and stuff, you know. So, but it's published. It's out there, you know, if to read.
Right.
Joe, I got to ask you a question. Do you have any Orang Indian items in your collection? I don't remember.
Just a ticket stub or so. BST had those Orang Indian flyers that came out last year in an auction. I didn't feel they fit in my collection, so I didn't pick any up. You know, I'm trying to focus on that stuff, you know. So
okay.
I do, but it's along the ticket and program, you know, side, so.
Yeah, because I was going to say, basically, what you're going to find from that team is basically a ticket stub or a program. Anything else that's out there is exceptionally rare because they played so little. And, you know, how much was actually saved from that point. And, you know.
Yeah. Chris, are you
that's pretty
Chris, it. Are you a collector? Did you see there were some Orang Indian auction items up last year? Are you a collector? Do you go after those kind of things?
Well, I mean, it depends. I'm not a huge collector, but I do like to preserve history. So a lot of times, especially with either research projects, you know, even getting a copy of something, you know, helps with my research. I technically don't need the original, but there are a few things that I do collect that I come across. I did see those postcards, and I think they had crates too. They had some of those original Orang crates, which those
crate.
Are very unique, you know, and stuff. So. Those type of items definitely are not easy to find, or they're not readily available. So especially early pro football in the 20s, it's tough to find some of that stuff. You know,
as you're doing research for a book, do you ever become aware of a collector who has some esoteric item that's related to, you know, to your subject, and you reach out to those collectors and get the permission to have a copy of it or anything?
Sure. It just depends, you know, if I know of somebody that might have something that's helpful, you know, like I said, it just depends which project and what's going on. Like, you know, like the Columbus Panhandle project, I did go and write to a lot of family members. Obviously, there's no member alive, but, you know, you maybe contact a family member if they just have something, even if it's just a photo or a newspaper article, a clipping, you know. That's not, you know, maybe at the Hall of Fame or, you know, in a library or something like that, or not on microfilm. So so every once in a while you come across, you know, something that might be very helpful, you know, within some of these projects.
Well, Chris, when you go to write that Largent book, I'm your man.
Chris, I got a question for you. It's off our script, but I know you could probably answer this. How, when you're writing... Are you on a strict schedule writing for your books? For example, do you give yourself, let's say, 4 months to finish the book, start to finish? Do you put in X amount of hours per day writing? I'm curious about that because You know, being a writer, but writing more, articles than anything. I've never written a book. I'm just curious as to what your schedule might be. I know what some other authors do as far as their schedule is concerned, but do you have a set schedule as far as that's concerned?
Well, when I start, the project, I usually have that in mind, although it's not set in stone. Usually my process has been I usually start it on my own, and then that usually lasts, somewhere between 6 months and a year. And then I present it to my publisher, just because I want to be further along to tell them when I might be done. Now, they're flexible, if they like the proposal and they say yes, I don't want to say, oh, yeah, now it's going to take me another year to do research and a year to write. And then, they're okay
right.
with that. But I prefer to be a little bit further along when I present it, because if they say no, then I got to go somewhere else. But they've been really good with my projects. But that's just for me. Like I said, I do like going in knowing, hey, it's going to take me this long to do the research. It's going to take me this long to write. And then this is when I turn it in. You have to turn it in roughly 8 or 9 months before it goes, when it comes out. And like I mentioned earlier, that's usually a fall type of release,
Right.
So like with the Orang book, I was done, around Labor Day of last year, just after the season started last year, and then they were able to do it in about 9 months, and it came out in May. So now if they need a little bit longer time, then, it would have been closer to training camps and stuff. But I always, when I go into a project, I usually start it first, get the research done, and then have a sort of schedule. Okay, now I know when I can finish it. Then I give them a sort of a hardcore date. Hey, I can finish it by Labor Day, by, January 1st or whatever, and then they know when it can come out. So.
That's interesting.
What's the time frame from when they get your final piece, your final book, manuscript, to them actually printing it and getting it produced to, and then getting it out to the public? I'm curious about that, too.
Well, usually, if I turn it in, they usually give you an 8 to 9 month schedule,
Okay. All right.
Now, depending on the length of it, I've always come in a little earlier. This was the first book that actually took 9 months, I still scratch my head. I was like, okay, it was one of my shorter books, and I'm like, but they usually give you that time frame, that it's going to be, once you turn it in, then it'll take 9 months. Usually, they come in under that, but because the big thing about it is they rather come in early than late, because then if you come in late,
right,
mainly from the publisher, then you're chewing up more money, more time. So it shouldn't take more than 9 months, but that's where they normally give you.
Okay. All right. I was always curious about that because I know a couple authors, not football authors, but they're basically fiction writers, and they bang out a couple books every year. And their process is once they start writing, they basically don't stop with it, and they could probably get it done in a 3-4 month period. But again, fiction obviously is different writing than, a nonfiction type of piece where you're doing a lot of research with regards to one way or the other.
Fiction's definitely a different animal. You can do it much quicker and it's more creative. You just sit down and you go.
Right. Yeah, well, fiction to me is much more difficult to write than nonfiction. I've always felt that. And again, especially when you're researching something, you got to make sure your facts are correct. And especially something with early football history, as you well know, there's not that many avenues other than old newspapers and old magazines. And if there are any members of the family still alive, to contact them, so on and so forth. So. That's pretty interesting one way or the other. Now, again, that kind of relates to the third question we were going to ask you, which you've given it some. Do you have anything else to add for background as to how you're developing your ideas for your books? We know what the process is, give or take that 8 or 9 months that you have once you present it to them. But what other ideas go into developing your ideas for books? More so looking at subjects that have never been touched before, or looking at something you're more interested in than something else? How does that work for you?
Well, for me, I guess I sort of go right down the middle with my book project. The first three books that I did were kind of ones that I wanted to do based on, you know where I grew up. You know, being from Ohio, I did the oral history book. Columbus Panhandles is my hometown. Columbus, Ohio's NFL team and pro team that nobody really – I mean, I get it. Everybody loves the Ohio State Buckeyes in Columbus. But we did have an NFL and pro team that was very good at times. So, and then Joe Carr was from Columbus, Ohio, and he was the – you know, first was second president, you know, after Thorpe in the NFL, and nobody had written a biography on him. So I knew I wanted to do those projects. And then the one since has sort of been ones that sort of just come to me, you know, like I didn't, like when Joe Carr was finished, I just happened to run into a Dutch Clark sort of research for whatever reason. And then I found out that his two sons were still alive. And I started talking to them, and they were like, yeah, we got these scrapbooks and we'll do interview. And it just like, then I was like, okay, I want to write about Dutch Clark. You know, it wasn't that I planned it out. Like I knew, you know, and then, you know, like the Niner book was, that's my favorite team. You know, I grew up with Joe Montana and Jerry Rice were my favorite players. Although Rice did not play on the 84 team, but I wanted to interview guys from the team, and I just wanted to do something different. I didn't want to, you know, although I love going back to, I call them the Stone Age and sitting in microfilm rooms, but I wanted to do something a little bit different, which was to interview the players and the coaches and just sort of let them tell their story of this season.
Wow.
You know, so, and then Urang was the same way. I, you know, years ago, I did a little bit of research and, you know, tracked down the Waterlingo's son. And I was like, you know what, I always thought I might go back to that story. So, so it just, you know, like I said, sometimes
cool.
I think I know what I want to do, and then there's other times where something just might pop in and just, you know, and I think Dutch Clark's a perfect example. I had no desire really to write, not that I didn't like him, but once I started reading up on him and we actually had a few of his games here, and because some of these guys who you only read about, like in the newspapers, but when I saw the few games that he played and saw how his feet moved and how he hit the hole and he always was going forward. And it just like, wow, you know what? He was as good as the press clippings. And, you know, so, and I sort of like, you know what? Now I want to write about him, you know? So, so it can come from different things.
It's interesting. That book was probably my favorite book of that you wrote, the Dutch Clark one, for the simple reason. So little has been written about the Detroit Lions, in my opinion, especially their early history. There's just nothing there, you know what I mean? Unless you pick up the old programs or whatever and you decipher the information for yourself. I always thought that book that you wrote on Dutch Clark and the Lions was just so informative to me. That was another book, you know, I picked it up and I didn't put it down until I finished it because it was fascinating to me. But again, being a historian of the game, I enjoy that kind of information, especially learning about stuff that I really never knew occurred type of thing. And I think a lot of people feel that way when they're reading, you know, a book like that or your Joe Carr book or even the Panhandle book with regards to, true early football history. So that
I loved the cover on the Dutch Clark book, just that handsome, rugged, you know, later on in his life kind of look.
Yeah. I mean, excellent. It's just truly an excellent story that you wrote there, and it's really, you know, well developed and really informative, which is what, you know, what I want out of a nonfiction book, especially on football history, you know.
Yeah. So, Chris, you're obviously, like I said, you have an impressive resume. You're surrounded by NFL history, and you've written about NFL history. I have to ask, who are your favorite characters that you've bumped into, you've read about, et cetera, while you're involved in the hobby? I mean, I guess that's a hard question to ask. You know, so let's say, who's your modern, you know, modern favorite player and or person involved in it, and who's your vintage favorite player or person involved in it?
You talk about in the collectible field?
NFL.
Or NFL.
Let's say.
I would say, obviously, I think Joe Montana and Jerry Rice are my era, like when I was growing up and playing and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But the other guy I would have to say, although I did not see him play, is Johnny Unitas. I just love You know, I do like the 50s, although, you know, I think the 20s and 30s are my favorite era. That's why I like to write about it. But the 50s is another era. You know, like I said, I haven't sort of, you know, jumped into that era to write about it quite as much, but it is a great era. And Johnny Unitas is probably the one guy, like I said, anything that, you know, any image or article or any collectible or cart, like, yeah, I tend to stop and take a look at it. Like, ooh, you know, what's Johnny U doing there, you know, with the crew cut and the high tops. Can't beat that.
Yeah, yeah, you can almost break that up by era, where it's like pre 45, 50, 50 to 70, 70, it's almost unfair to ask that. It's like, who's the greatest quarterback of all time? You've got your Otto Grahams, you've got your Johnny U's, your Bart's. I mean, it's by era, and it's, you know, it's unfair to say that Otto Graham wouldn't have survived in an NFL with, you know, with other teams, although he did hold his own. You know, could Johnny Unitas play nowadays? Would Tom Brady be able to take, linemen hitting him where they don't, you know, pander to, you know, yeah. Because,
mm-hmm.
You know, I've got my favorites by era, you know, Jim Thorpe, Red Grange, you know, ditto. Don Hudson is one of those people that I want to know more about.
It's an incredible story, too, if you really think about it. How little is known about the 1920 and 1930s of the NFL. Whether, you know, you look at a PFRA that's trying to keep that story alive, you look at Gridiron Greats magazine, we try to, you know, anything that we can pick up from that era, we try to publish at the same time. But it's an amazing story, really, to be told, and there's so much that still needs to be can be written about it and learned about it. But again, it's becoming more and more difficult as that whole generation now of looking at grandchildren and the like are passing. You know, that oral history is pretty much lost. So it's more research than anything else.
I totally agree. That's the reason why I think I like tackling these topics. I mean, I love Joe Montana. I mean, I grew up watching him, but you know, outside of doing that one book, I was like, you know what? Everybody knows about him. You know, there's a lot you can see him, all his highlights, but some of these other topics, and you know, and that's why we love the game so much. It's like, well, these are the ones that started. These are the pioneers, and I think those stories get lost. Like I said, even if a handful of people read about the Ourang Indians and Walter Lingo and Jim Thorpe, I'm okay with that. You know, and they'll get to learn about it, and hopefully future generations might pick it up and like, oh, this is what it was like, and this is what this team was like, and you know, and you can definitely learn from some of these sort of stories that, you know, haven't been written about as much.
I ran into
Joe Montana. Go ahead, Gavin.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I ran into Joe Montana at an airport leaving Mexico in Cabo once, and he was having trouble, you know, speaking to somebody to buy something, and I stepped in and pretended to know Spanish way better than I actually do to interpret them. it didn't go very well. It didn't go very well.
Did you snag an autograph off him? Or?
I did. I had him. I was dumb. I asked him for an autograph. He signed my boarding pass, and then I had to give my boarding pass up to get on the plane. I was a young autograph seeker, that's for sure. So what's next, Chris? I mean, you're surrounded by NFL legends. You've written some amazing books. I mean, other than the Steve Largent idea I gave you, which I expect royalties on, you know, what's next? What's sitting on your desk?
Well, I think you'll be excited, Joe, because this is going to be right up your alley since we've mentioned his name a couple times. But if you probably know, in 2019, the NFL will be celebrating its 100th season. And so this is an idea that I think I've been wanting to write about for a while. So the first sort of big superstar celebrity athlete was Red Grange. So I'm going to be writing a full-scale biography on the Galloping Ghost for that season. So since history will be a huge thing, you know, so it'll be about him.
Cue the music, Captain. There are tears coming up, welling up in my eyes right now, Chris. I absolutely love it. That's cool. If you need any early photos or early tickets or, you know, et cetera, give me a shout out. I'm incredibly pleased. I'd be honored to contribute.
Yeah, I'm still doing research, so yeah, I'm I'll be looking for anything, see what can be helpful, and you know, so but yeah, so it's so that's next on the agenda.
You gave me goosebumps, sir. I love it.
That's great. I envy
cool.
you because you have a lot of energy, Chris, to continue to work on this, and that's great. It serves our football hobby and the history of the hobby and the history of the game very well to keep it and preserve it. And you are a great spokesman for them and for our hobby. And I know I appreciate it and I enjoy your books. They're prominent in my football library. Quick question, though, and I'm going to put everybody on the spot, and I don't know how true this is or not. Does anyone have any idea how many books have been written on professional football? I'm talking all the leagues since the inception of the NFL. And I don't know how true this is or not.
1/10 of how many books have been written about baseball?
No, that's not a right answer.
Now, there's a book that Ralph Hickok, I don't know if you know him, he did a bibliography, and he said he did a search for football on the WorldCat, which is the library center, and he got 39,554 hits. So,
wow.
Can you be more specific, Chris?
But he said he brought the number down, because he did a bibliography, he brought the number down to a manageable of 10,000 or so. So in his bibliography, he's got close to 10,000. So.
Wow. The gentleman I was talking to, he estimated 7,000 to 8,000.
Did he? Okay.
And again, I told him, I think it would probably be more than that because there's a lot of stuff we don't even know about that's out there, self-published books and things of that nature. And I know my football library here at home, I mean, I got probably close to 500 books, if not more, but I have a lot of college books,
too.
So, it's literally overwhelming. And I always said to myself, well, I would really like to have a complete football library. You know, have, you know, like you would see in England, you know, a library room of thousands of books there. But I'm saying to myself, what the heck could I do with 7,000 books? It's beyond belief. And I just couldn't handle it. But again, if I see any old football book from the 20s or the 30s or the 40s, whether it's college, fiction, or professional, I do pick it up. So I probably got about 40, 50 books from those eras. And I just find it fascinating reading one way or the other. But, I knew there's a large amount of books out there.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, we're almost out of time for you. I truly thank you for being on again. I look forward to your work. And I'm also looking forward to reading your Jim Thorpe book, and it'll be reviewed in Gridiron Greats magazine also. And it's very interesting to actually hear the thoughts and the ideas coming from a writer, especially someone who writes as well as you do. And I thank you for being on the show this evening.
No, I thank you, Bob and Joe. Like I said, it's always a pleasure to talk. And like I said, talk about these type of subjects, it's always up my alley.
Yeah.
So I appreciate the time. And you guys have always been supportive of my project. So so I appreciate you having me.
Perfect. Thank you so much for coming on, Chris.
Thank you.
Chris Willis.
All right.
Well-known author and the head of the research library at NFL Films, the dream job we think about, although I don't know, my dream job would probably be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame handling the memorabilia or the publication area. That's the other question that was brought up by this gentleman, too. I was talking to him at the National, and he came up, he just started talking. We were talking about the magazine, and he said, how many football programs, you know, are out there? And I said, well, you got to multiply them by, you know, the amount of games that have been played. That's pretty much can be found. So I said, you know, there are, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of programs out there if you're going to have that type of collection. Same thing with media guides, same thing with, any type of, you know, football publication that you're looking at. So it's an interesting view. I've always liked football books, and I know my library's grown dramatically over the years, and I truly enjoy it.
It's like we talked about last week. How many how many games were played, how many programs were produced, how many programs got thrown away after the game, how many made it home, how many have been lost in fires and floods. I mean, you know, nobody knows.
It's amazing. And, you know, getting back to what we were talking about in auctions and on eBay, I picked up over the past couple of months, and I'm just literally shocked at what I'm seeing on some prices. I'm picking up a lot of 1940s, early 1950 Yale football programs for like $5.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't get it. I don't understand why they're offering them that inexpensively, number one. And number two, I don't, you know, and again, I've gotten a few from what I feel are pretty normal dealers. You know, why the rush now to try to unload them at that price doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. Not unless they, you know, got them for nothing or they picked them up for pennies type of thing. But to me, those are really beautifully produced programs, you know, nice artwork, good articles. There's a lot of meat to them as compared to the, you know, programs of today, which are pretty much more generic than anything else. So, I just don't get it sometimes. Don't understand.
I've got some old Yale, Harvard, you know, ticket stubs that are from like, you know, 1894, you know, stuff like that. And, I mean, if I put those up for sale, they wouldn't get much. I mean, you know, so I don't sell them because it's like, it's kind of cool to have 100, you know, 20-year-old ticket from two powerhouses, perennial powerhouses of the time. You know, it's worth more just as kind of a cool memorabilia thing for me to have than it would for me to sell it. I mean, because the demand's just not there, like you mentioned.
Yeah, it's amazing. That brings up a real quick story. We're running out of time here, but I had a local guy here in Wallingford. He called me out of the blue, and he said to me, I understand, you know, you have the magazine, blah, 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 you know, about football, blah, blah, blah. I said, sure. So we ended up meeting at the local Dunkin' Donuts here over a cup of coffee, and he pulled out a bunch of Yale football stubs from the 1930s and the 1940s. And he said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. He said, you know a lot more about football than me. He says, I want to give these to you. And I said, well, let me pay you, you know, give you something for them. He said, no, buy my coffee and you can have the ticket stubs. So I kind of laughed about it. I had a feeling the guy was kind of, he was more concerned about preserving what he had, and he didn't want to sell it, nor did he want me to turn around,
yeah,
which I haven't. I wouldn't flip them on him in any way, shape, or form. You know, somebody gives me something, it's in my collection. I will not sell it. So I think he was just happy. It went to a new home, and it was going to be taken care of. But, you know, when you showed that 1894 ticket stub, how many are in existence? I mean, why wouldn't you want to, you know, pick one up for your collection? That's what I don't understand sometimes.
Totally.
You know? It's truly amazing, to say the least. Well, we're on our two-minute warning. I think we picked up a lot on tonight. Joe, you go first.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel lazy. You know, Chris has written so many books. I have a hard time cranking out two or three Gridiron Great articles a year. I just suddenly I felt lazy listening to him.
Well, it's you know? Like I said, it's truly a discipline to do what he does, or any author to do that, with regards to, you know, being able to basically come out with a new book every 2 years and have a book of substance, not just write something for the sake of writing it, but just have something that that's really is impressive. And again, I go back to that Dutch Clark book. I reread it before, while I knew he was coming on to the show this past week. And again, it was another deal. I reread it, and it was one night. I'm sitting here, I'm reading it, and I didn't put it down. I read it a second time straight through. It's still a great book.
Yeah.
And it was interesting
to hear his writing style.
Yeah.
It was interesting to hear his writing style, because when I tend to pick a subject, I will create like a, you know, like here's how I want the story to go. An introduction with some sort of, you know, wit and banter, something funny. Give me a story and then dig into it and then end it with, you know, some sort of, you know, capper story, you know. I build how I want the paragraphs, graphs, and then move them around as I see fit. It's I write different. My wife has a journalism degree, so she makes fun of how I write, how I put stories together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's very interesting how authors write.
All right, we're going to wrap it up down to 30 seconds. Again, we're sponsored by MSB Sports Cards. Check out their website, msbsportscards.com. And check out the fall auction for BSC Auctions, bscauctions.com. We're going to be back at the end of October with a couple of shows. We're working on guests right now. First half of October, we're not going to be around. So we will probably talk to you and be back on the air in about 3 weeks for our next show. Joe, good talking, and we will be back in 3 weeks. And then November, you're going on a big trip, and we're going to be talking about that in October. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in a few weeks.
Until then.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, aka the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.